Good morning and welcome to part two in a three-part series on the creativity and chaos of medieval Jewish Provence. Really wonderful to see all of you. Thanks for venturing out here, at least virtually. I hope you all enjoy your last day of freedom here in Toronto to move about. And I guess as you see this beautiful background behind me from the Beit Midrash here in Or Chaim, appreciate it while you can, because it doesn't look like you'll be able to much longer. So last week we began with a brief introduction to the history of Jews in France. Generally, we spoke about how even already in the Bible refers to Jews traveling to France. We talked about specifically the area of Provence that we are discussing in greater detail. Some of the history, as Eric sent out with his the work called The Convert. It was a rocky history for the Jews. They definitely experienced persecution, but we were focusing on a period of a relative calm and peace, where there is an immense amount of scholarship, creativity, and on the one hand, an incredible amount of innovation, but also, as we'll see, some controversy and chaos as well. So last week, we began to focus on Rabbi Moshe the Preacher, also known as Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. And I want to get back to that in just a bit. However, I want to begin by reconsidering some of what we were talking about. And let me ask you the following question. I may have asked it last week, but let me ask it again. I imagine all of you at some point in your life have heard a sermon. What I want to ask you is, usually when a rabbi or a teacher or a preacher of any sort gives a sermon, there is most of the time, there's some text that they are using as a basis for their thoughts and their ideas and the message that they want to preach. But they often relate to it a little bit loosely. So here's what I want to ask. What do you think is the goal of a sermon generally? What is a sermon? What is the point of it? And what is the point of utilizing the text? Meaning, why not just get up there and say, and I'm going to make up a message now. If your message is an environmental one, you want to preach to your congregation about taking care of the environment and nature and the importance of living in the world that God gave to us, which is all really wonderful, why even bother with a text? Why not just get up there and start talking about it? What do you think?
The purpose of the sermon would be to help us interpret the text. I mean, the sermon is to teach us Torah. The lessons they're trying to show is that through Torah, you can learn these lessons.
Wow, I love that. I'm not sure everybody would agree with that, or all orators would agree with that, but I love that. What Linda is saying is, Rabbi Bergman, you're getting this all wrong. It's not that the preacher has a message that they want to deliver. Rather, it's that the preacher is there to teach Torah or to preach the lessons of their tradition and from God. And the point of the message is just to show that those messages that the Torah sends to us are relevant to our lives. But that's not the point. I really like that. But if that's true, what I would suggest then is that the way that a preacher learns a text or interprets a text needs to be very, conservative in a sense. Meaning you shouldn't be veering from the plain meaning or profound meaning of a text to give your message if the point is simply to teach the text and the message is sort of an afterthought. And I don't know. Does anyone else take issue with that? Does anyone here think that, no, sometimes preachers are primarily there to give a certain message or something that they want to tell their congregations or their audience, and they want to anchor it in text? What do you think, Rose? I see you raising your hand.
I think that, you know, if you look at any parasha or any text, it's got there's the pshat and there's the drash. And I think that it's not just the text-based learning, okay, like Rashi, but then there's something, there are deeper meanings within the text. And then you have to try and take the text, look at it, analyze it, and perhaps bring it so you can, usually not only do you teach, you're not trying to teach a text, but you're trying to teach a lesson in the text. So I would say a lesson of yesteryear to bring forward to today is my vision. I mean, you try and make it relevant to this day. So I think a sermon has much more meaning than the actual text, but the fact of the relevance. And I think often sermons are drenched in that.
Beautiful. I 100% agree. I think what you're sort of saying is it's somewhere in the middle. It's somewhere in the middle. You're looking for a deeper meaning of the text. Yes, Dahlia. Sorry, you're on mute. I'm sorry. I think you have to unmute. I can't do it for you. I asked you to unmute.
I would like to say that.
Okay, can you hear now?
Yeah, and we'll get to you in a second, Paul. Sure, go for it.
Okay, that when a rabbi or somebody's interpreting it, and maybe they're telling a story, it's easier to remember it. It, you know, rather than just reciting Torah. So by being giving a lecture and setting it out, people may remember it more.
Right. Right. I hear that. So you're saying the point of the message is so that people actually remember it. It's almost like, because they're also just going to forget. Okay. I totally hear that. But, and it's almost like we're saying really the point is to teach the Torah, but the message is there to help people remember the Torah that you teach. Okay.
Exactly.
Did you want to add something?
Yeah. I'd like to say that as someone who does text-based work, I find it very frustrating when somebody is speaking and you realize that there's a tenuous relationship between what they're saying, which is their agenda, and the text they're basing it on. So if there's a disconnect there, then as far as I'm concerned, there's no credibility.
I hear that. No credibility is strong. That's strong. So this is what I want to talk about. I want to argue is that I think delivering a sermon, at least in the way the rabbis saw it, is somewhere between an art and a science. Meaning, I think Paul's right in that it can't be totally disconnected from the text, at which point, you know, you're using the text as totally artificial. It can't be completely disconnected. But also, I think there is a certain poetic license in how we use Torah. And I think that's because the Torah is a book which is meant to be meaningful and meant to be understood in various different ways. It's not meant to just be read and translated and then you move on, right? You know, all these stories in the Torah are there to inform the way that we live our lives. They're not just there to, okay, I know what happened and now I can move on. No, of course, you're supposed to ask questions and delve deeper into the stories. So with this, I want to go back to, I know we sort of breezed over this last week, but I want to go back to our study of Rabbi Moshe the Preacher. I'm going to share my screen. I hope that you see it. I'm just going to note that I know I sent out the source sheet. I mean, the PowerPoint, I made it. I'm constantly looking it over and I made a few additions. So I apologize for that. But here, I hope that I'm going to share my screen now. And I hope you'll be able to see. Here we go. You see everything clear? Does everybody see where we are? Give me a thumbs up if you can. Awesome. Thanks, Rose. I always count on you for the thumbs up. Appreciate it. So we are now, let's remember what we're studying. So Rabbi Moshe Adarshan in this midrash, in this rabbinic discourse, is going to comment on a very plain story in the Bible, which talks about the offerings the princes of Bnei Israel gave when the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was dedicated. And if you know, we noted, I would say, two basic problems. One we're not going to focus on as much, which is the Torah repeats the story of princes giving offerings for the tabernacle again and again and again. And it's the same offering every single time. What's the point of repeating it every time? But the other question is just, even if it was just one time, why do I need to know what the offerings were? Like, I'm not the one giving the offering in the temple. Wouldn't it have just sufficed to tell me the princes of the Israel gave a wonderful offerings to the temple? Something like that. Do I need to know how much each bull weighed and how many bulls and what animals and how many animals? Like, why is that any of that relevant? And so we started looking at some of the comments and the symbolism that Rabbi Moshe, the preacher, saw in this. So let's do a brief review without the details. But I think what you do see is that it's between an art and a science. On the one hand, the connections seem pretty loose. They seem pretty loose. Like, you look at, for instance, here it says, just as we saw last week, it says that they offered a silver bowl. In Hebrew, the words silver bowl is ki'arat kesef. Ki'arat kesef, if you use the idea of gematria, numerical value of every letter, I laid it out here for you on the source sheet, it adds up to 930. So the words ki'arat kesef, even though it's just a silver bowl, you look at a silver bowl, it's simply a nice receptacle that they're giving in dedication for this temple. No, it really also represents this notion of Adam the first, Adam Harishon, because if you add up the letters in ki'arat kesef, it's 930. And 930 is the amount of years that Adam the first lived. And that's what's also going on. And on and on. It's 130. It weighs 130 because Adam had children when he was 130 years old. And Mizrach, and then the next item donated, it relates to Noah. And you can look at the numerical value there. And the 70 nations, and the gold, and the one palm, the one ladle rather, the gold ladle that weighed 10 shekels, because kaf means a ladle, but it also means a palm. And a palm relates to the fact that God gave the Torah to the Jews with his hand. And it's 10 because it's the 10 commandments, and on. We talk the 613 commandments. The cow is Avraham. The ram is Isaac. The lamb is Yaakov. We got Moshe and Aaron there. One offering is Moshe, Moses and Aaron. And then we get to the different areas of Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, and the priests, Levites and Israelites, and all this is what Rabbi Moshe, the preacher, sees in this. It's all these references to completely different parts of the Torah, to all these important figures in world and Jewish history, and we're supposed to see all of these in the text. Now, I think Paul would probably look at this and say, "What in the world are you talking about, Rabbi? What do you mean? It's just what elk, the gamat, you're going to add up the letters and then it adds up to this number. And then you could say that it has to do with Adam the first. Really? Really? Like, is that really what the Torah meant to convey by telling us that the word ki'arat kesef, you know, means a silver bowl, but it also means Adam the first? Right? So I think that's a very good question. And I think that there may, you know, there probably is some sort of tradition going on here. But I think, again, it's something between an art and a science. And what Rabbi Moshe the preacher is doing is looking at these texts and using a very clever way of interpretation to bring out a deeper meaning. And I think it's to answer an objective question. Meaning, you look at this text you ask. Number one, why tell us all this at all? And number two, why repeat this again and again? And I think he's saying, well, even though they all brought the same sacrifice, they may have had different interpretations of their sacrifice and what they do when they brought it. They had different intentions, different kavanot. And that there's more than that sometimes in life, I would say, there is more when you look at someone doing something, there might be a deeper meaning beyond the surface. There are different layers of meaning. And so you look at this and you see somebody giving a silver bowl, but it's much more than a silver bowl. Because the person giving that had a lot of thoughts and ideas in their mind when they did so. That's number one. And it's also conveying this idea that at this point in history, the Jewish people are now, you know, in the desert, and it's well beyond the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but that when we experience something in life, we should see that it's a progression, there's a context, and that the Jewish people are continuing a mission that was started at the very beginning of history, and that this new accomplishment relates to Adam and Noah, who be the pillars of humanity, moving on to this progression to giving the Torah to the Avot, Moshe and Aaron, that the leaders of the Jewish people are the force, the driving force behind this incredible accomplishment of bringing God to live among the Jewish people in this close proximity. And so what I'm arguing is, and I think, you know, and how you interpret all this is up for interpretation, right? But what I'm arguing is that, yes, you wouldn't look at the text necessarily and say, oh, this is what it means. No, you wouldn't. I don't think you would. I don't think Rabbi Moshe Darshan says you should. It also just means a bull. But he's looking for a deeper meaning, and he has a certain methodology how he does it. I think he takes it seriously. But I think the point is that he's asking us that when we look at the Torah, to look for a deeper meaning, to look for connections, to look for the fact that it's not just this one word and all we look at is a silver bowl, but there's more to it. There's a deeper levels and layers of meaning here. That's what I wanted to convey. And I think now you look at this and you see that even though maybe not from this word, but these themes are there. We should appreciate the fact that the tabernacle is not a standalone event. Nothing in our lives is a standalone event. Nothing in the lives of our community and our people is a standalone event. It's all a progression. It's all this great march through history. And it's all built upon our forefathers and foremothers. And it's all incumbent upon us to continue progressing. So I think that's where he's going from. These messages are there. These ideas are there. And he has a creative way of relating it to the text. Okay, any thoughts on that? Objections? Observations? Okay. Yes.
I have no problem with this. As a matter of fact, I think it's ingenious.
Okay, I appreciate that.
I think that it is rooted in the text.
Right.
It's making a connection that does not seem to be artificial. It seems to be rooted in the text. So I have no problem with this at all.
I'm glad to hear. I don't want you to have a problem with it, Paul. Glad to hear that. Yeah, so, but that's exactly the point I'm trying to make. But you see that it's creative. There's a certain creativity here. It's the role of the preacher is not just reading a text and telling you what it means. It's also not just giving you some message that they came up with. It's something in between, which requires a certain skill and creativity. So let's look at one more example of this, and another dry text, which at first glance has almost no meaning. And let's look at what Rabbi Moshe Preacher does with this text. So now we're looking in Bamidbar, chapter 33. And this is also a very perplexing story in that we don't know why it's here. So this is describing the travels of Israel in the desert. And I'll just read it to you. I didn't bring the whole thing. It's actually very long, but I think this, you get the point from looking at this. It says, these are the marches of the Israelites who started out from the land of Egypt, troop by troop, the chars of Moses and Aaron. Okay, so this is where the Jewish people went in the desert as they sojourned from Egypt to the land of Israel. Moses recorded the starting points of their various marches as erected by the Lord. So God told Moses to write this down. Their marches by starting points were as follows. They set out from Ramses in Egypt. The first month, the 15th day. What's special about the first month, the 15th day? Anybody know? What day is that on the Jewish calendar? The first month, the 15th
Pesach.
Day. Pesach, right? The first month here refers to Nisan. The 15th day refers to the first day of Passover. So they set out on the first day of Passover. It was after they gave the Pesach offering that the Israelites started out defiantly in plain view of all the Egyptians, right? They just marched out in front of the Egyptians, and while the Egyptians were burying the firstborn. Then we move on. The Israelites set out from Ramses and camped at Sukkot. Then they moved from Sukkot and camped at Etam. Then they moved from Etam, they camped in Pi-Hahiroth, which faces Baal Tzephon. And on and on and on. There, I think, over there, as we'll see, there is a whole chapter of the Torah just saying they went here and they stopped. And then they went somewhere else and they stopped. And from there, they went somewhere else and they stopped. And from there, they went somewhere else again and again and again. And what's the obvious question you ask when you look at this? Who cares? Yes, Rose says, okay, good. Thank you. Like, you know, it's really interesting to know. It's interesting information, but why, what does this teach us? What relevance does this have? Now, there are different approaches to this, but I want to present Rabbi Moshe. And before I do that, let me ask the following question, okay? Looking at this, if I were to tell you that God had the Israelites march around in the desert for 40 years from place to place to place, okay? And now you're going to grade, this is a bit of a dangerous thing to do, but you're going to grade God in terms of how he treated the Jewish people. And I would ask you, is this Hashem being nice to the Jewish people? Is this Hashem being generous to Jewish people when he has them march around the desert from place to place for 40 years or not? Yes, Rose.
It was necessary because they were a mentality of enslaved people and they were unable to reach the promised land. And so he had to let a generation pass for this to happen. So it sounds terrible, but if you read deeper into the meaning, one recognizes that this generation was not ready to go to the land of milk and honey. And that is the reason why this happened.
So yeah, I 100% agree with your point. And Rose points out that it's not like the Jews were innocent here. If you read the stories of the text in the Torah, there are a lot of sinning and complaining going on, but you admit, and you're saying that this was necessary, but this isn't an expression of Hashem loves Jewish people. Rose, you are agreeing that it looks bad. It looks really bad.
It's an expression because you see, it's like a parent and a child. So a parent has to teach a child and the child has to make its own decision. So here is God being the parent. He is teaching the road to the child and they need lessons. And that's why, I mean, it's like saying you can have a candy or you can do something and then we will give you a reward.
Right. So I agree with that. It's beautiful. You're already jumping towards the solution. Any other thoughts? What do you think, Dahlia? I see you wanted to speak up. No? Okay. So I would have thought that at first glance, this seems pretty mean. Meaning, to your point, Rose, you're 100% right, but he could have had them like just march slowly. Like, couldn't they just stayed still or, you know, and just waited it out in the desert? So here's the thing. Here's where Moshe Darshan comes and flips this on its head. So take a look at what he says here. And again, this is from Rashi. Much of the text that we have from by Moshe the Preacher is from Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, the famed commentator on Chumash. Ooh, sorry about that. Again, I think a few people just joined. I apologize if there was problems with the link. I'm very sorry about that. I'll have to, I think in the follow-up email, maybe I'll change the link and send a new one. Maybe we'll just have to make a new tiny CC link. But thank you all for who eventually did get here. As we read about the Jews traveling through the desert, we can talk about the Jews traveling through cyberspace to get to their webinar on a Wednesday morning. But I'm happy that you at least arrived. So here's what Rashi says here in the name of Rabbi Moshe Darshan. Okay, he says, why are these stations recorded here? Why do we need all this information about where the Jews went and where they stopped and how long? Well, what's the point of this? He says, in order to make known the loving acts of the omnipresent, that although we had decreed against them to make them move about and wander in the wilderness, you should not think that they wandered and moved about without cessation from one station to another all 40 years, and that they had no rest. For you see here, there are only 42 stages. There's 42. If you go, you know, everybody's welcome to go back home or you're already at home. After the lecture to look at and count up all the places, there's 42. 42. That sounds like a lot to me. But hold on a second. Deduct from them 14, all of which were in the first year, which were necessary, right? In the first year, they were just on their way to Israel. So then we have 28. Before the decree was made, from the time when they journeyed from Ramses until they came to Ritma. Okay, right? So the point is, why the Jews had to wander in the desert? Why did the Jews not just go right into Eretz Yisrael? Why couldn't they just enter in right away? What was the point of that? Anybody remember? Why did the Jews have to wander in the desert?
Well,
this is in the Torah. This is explicit. Why? It was a punishment. A punishment for
punishment.
For what?
The spies.
The spies, correct. They sent the spies. So the point is, until they send the spies, it's not a punishment. Until they send the spies, it's just traveling. So we're down to 14. Further deduct from them the 8 stages which are after Aaron's death, those from Mount Hor to the plains of Moab. Okay, so the last year, Aaron died in the last year. So the first year they went for 14, okay? The last year they went another 8. It follows that during the whole of the 38 years, they made only 20 journeys. It's 20 over 38 years. 20 journeys, because you deduct 14 and then 8. Now, 20 journeys sounds like a lot, but over 38 years, not so crazy. So the point is, and here's what I think the point he's making here, right? Most of the preacher's making. You look at this, you think, oh, Hashem, God is being cruel to the Jewish people. But if you look at it deeper, it's actually not so. Actually, it's quite understandable. They traveled less than once a year for the duration, for the majority of their time in the desert, less than once a year. Now let's take another think. Now, okay, so at this point, you could say it's a nice little thing. Okay, so Hashem was a little nicer, but I think it's more than that, right? Because again, God's punishing them. But even when Hashem punishes Israel, he doesn't give them the full brunt of his anger. There's still some mercy in there. There's still some mercy within the punishment. And taking another step back then, whether you agree with this specific interpretation or not, the message of looking for God's mercy within the punishment, the message of trying to find that even as you experience, as you all are right now, a difficult time, to see where God's love is still manifest is in and of itself a very important message. And I think that's part of the point. It's not just about the message, it's about the idea of looking for in this horrific time period in our history where the Jews are wandering the desert and slowly dying out. Even within that, Hashem didn't make them move every day, every month. No, once a year. And even less. So the whole notion that of doing this is, I'm gonna quote a phrase here. Is there's this phrase called omnisignificance. This is a phrase that's been used recently by Professor James Kugel, who's a Bible professor. As he describes it, the slightest details of the biblical text have a meaning that is both comprehensible and significant. Nothing in the Bible ought to be explained as a product of chance, or for that matter, as an emphatic or rhetorical form or anything similar. Nor ought its reasons to be assigned to the realm of divine unknowables. Every detail is put there to teach something new and important, and it is capable of being discovered by careful analysis. So what this is saying is that there is nothing in the Torah that's just there. Everything, every word, every letter, every phrase, every verse is there to teach you an important lesson that you, if you read the text carefully enough, can arrive at. And this is his theory. This is why the sages already in the Second Temple period and even beyond that look, you know, try in such creative ways to derive all sorts of laws and lessons from the Torah, which on the first glance, you know, you don't read the text and see them. It's because they think the Torah as the divine word of God is inherently meaningful. Every letter is meaningful. Now, taking a step back, does it have to be so that literally every turn of phrase has a deeper lesson? I don't know. I'm not sure you have to agree that literally every word you spelled it this way and not that way because this letter teaches you something. I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. But I think the general idea of trying to find meaning in the text of the Bible is what they are getting at. That a whole parsha in the Torah, to just leave it and say, okay, it's sort of strange that it's here, but let's move on. That's not something that the rabbis and Rabbi Moshe, the preacher, wanted to do. So even in this dry geographical, you know, detailing of a journey in the desert, it's actually teaching you with the love of God. And not just the love of God, it's teaching you with the love of God even while he punishes you. And the method, I think, maybe the most salient point to take from Rabbi Moshe Darshan's approach is the notion of constantly looking for meaning. And maybe not just constantly looking for meaning in the biblical text, but constantly looking for meaning in your life. Right? Because the approach of reading the Torah this way is the constant search for meaning, even in those moments or events or experiences that seem just dry and normal. But maybe you can find something meaningful about them. And maybe that's the most salient point to take, the most important point to take from by Moses, the Darshan. So that, now we're going to move on to our second rabbinic hero in our series, but I want to stop in case somebody has any questions, difficulties, observations. Okay. Everyone's good? Good? Beautiful. Let's move on. Yes.
I would just say that I thought also for future generations, this itemizing of where we were and where we went to, I mean, it's a way of sort of saying we were here.
Right. 100%. 100%. If you look on that verse, Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman says something similar so that we can go back and say, you know, oh, so that's where they were. And that's very interesting that they were there. And you know, even nowadays, we trying to locate those places in the desert and figuring out how anyone might have known about those places if they weren't present at the time. So 100%. It makes the history seem more real also. I agree with that. Right, Moses the preacher is going for a deeper, I think, lesson, but I 100% agree with that. Yes, yes, Moish.
I have a thought that's actually never occurred to me, and I don't know why not. The trop that we use for Mas'e is the very majestic trop that is reserved for the two recordings of Revelation and the Kriyat Yamsuf. And there's other also journeys recorded for briefer periods, but it just strikes me that as much as each individual location is important, I think really it's to highlight that our lives are really journeys, and that there's so, journeys in so many ways, whether they're physical, whether they're journeys in learning the Torah and all sorts of other journeys. It seems to me that when we talk about journeys in a concentrated way, that the trop tells us, you know, the journeys themselves are majestic.
Beautiful.
I just thought about that now, so thank you.
Absolutely. Just to know, Moish refers to the cantillation notes, the musical notes that we use to read the Torah when we read it in synagogue. It's very striking. There's a special tune often used for that paragraph in the Torah describing different travels. It's a very exciting sort of sounding musical note. And you hear it and you're asking, well, what's so exciting about this? They move from one place to another. Thank you. And Moish suggests that it's to teach you that it's not just them that they're journeying, that life is a journey and that you just try to find meaning in each destination. So thank you for that, Moish. Okay, let's now get back to let's begin our study. I don't think we're going to finish this today. Of a really important, fascinating, controversial, provocative figure, and that is Rabbi Avraham Ibn David the Ra'avad. So now I'm going to share my screen again, and we will begin that. Okay. So let us begin. A bit about his life. I don't have that much biographical information, but you get a hint of his reputation. So Rabbi Avraham Ibn David is also known as Rabbah, is born in Narvon. And you know what? After I read this slide, I have a map just to give you an idea of where he goes. Okay, so that's where he's born. He studied in Lunel, which is a bit to the east of that in Provence, under two very important rabbinic scholars of the time. Again, Provence is full of great Torah scholars. There's a lot of them in different varieties with different focuses. We can't get to all of them. So two of them were Rabbi Moshe ben Yosef and Meshulam ben Yaakov. It's interesting to note, Rabbi Meshulam ben Jacob was someone who was also, aside from being a great Torah scholar, also very knowledgeable in the realm of philosophy and interested in science and Arabic. I mention that now because we don't necessarily get the same impression from Rabbi Avraham Ibn David, who we're going to study in more depth. But his rabbi, his teacher, had very broad interests. Okay. And then he ultimately settled to the east in Posquare, where he founded a yeshiva. And I brought you here a description of him from, again, the itinerary, as we saw last week, the itinerary of Benjamin of Tudela. Benjamin of Tudela was a Jewish explorer who traveled from Spain throughout Europe, even to Asia, and he wrote about his journeys. And here's how he describes the Rabbi Avraham ben David. From there is two parsings to Posquare, which is a large place containing about 40 Jews, not huge, with an academy under the auspices of the great Rabbi, Rabbi Abraham, son of David, a blessed memory. An energetic and wise man, great as a Talmudical authority. People come to him from a distance to learn the law at his lips, and they find rest in his house, and he teaches them. Of those who are without means, he also pays the expenses, for he is very rich. So Rabbi Avram ibn David, as you can see, very prominent, well-known. People travel from far and near to hear him teach Torah. Not only is he a great Torah scholar, he's also very wealthy. I don't know exactly what his profession was, but apparently he acquired a lot of wealth, which enabled him to found this yeshiva, and he has a great reputation. And I will add that he was the authority in his time. When he said something, in his eyes, that was the conclusion, which we shall get to. Just to give you, if you want, let me actually ask you, would you appreciate a bit of a map about where he traveled from? Let me share that with you in just a second. I'm going to stop the share of the, I'll just share you with you my Google map over here. And this way, if you want, you can drive and follow the path for Abraham ibn David. So you see here, this is a bit up close. This is Narbon. I'll zoom out for a second so you get a chance to see where exactly this is. Okay, so you see here, this is where my cursor here is in the middle. This is where he was. To the bottom left is Spain and Portugal. You know, this is southern France, really in the center. Italy is over here. So to zoom in a little bit, he starts in Narbona, and ultimately goes slightly to the north and to the east to Lunel, which should be somewhere around here. And then ultimately, over here, actually. And then this Valvert, as it's known nowadays, or Valve, I don't know how to pronounce it, I'm going to be honest. Rose, maybe you know, I don't know. Is what used to be called Pasquare, where the Rabad, where his yeshiva was and where he did the most of his teaching and the most of his writing. Okay? So that's what we're talking about here, this area of France. Let's get back to the slide. Just 1 second. Here we go. Now, just to show you how he was regarded, okay, his reputation. He had quite a reputation. So I'm quoting you now from the work of Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, also known as the Rashba. The Rashba is a very important figure in Jewish law, one of the primary Chachmei Sfarad, sages of Spain, who wrote a number of a lengthy commentary on Talmud, as well as a number of legal works. This is the introduction to his work on the dietary laws and laws of kashrut, the laws of, you know, all the basics of what food is kosher, what's not kosher, if my pot and pan are encounter, you know, hot non-kosher food, is the pot and pan okay, and what if it's a mixture? So this is an introduction to that work. And here's what he writes. He says as follows: regarding the laws of immersion pools themselves, or actually maybe, and this also relates to marital law and the laws relating to marital purity. So he says, regarding the laws of mikvaot, of a mikveh, of what is a valid mikveh and what is not, I will not insert myself. Rashba says, I'm not going to touch that. I'm staying away from the laws of immersion pools. Why? For a holy one has already stood. The great Rabbi Avraham, son of Rabbi David, may his memory be blessed. The Rabbad already discussed the laws of immersion pools. Since he did, I'm not going to touch it. And explain their matters at great length. Who can come after the king, after which he has already done and purified, as if from the mouth of Moses, the revealer of depths, and elucidated that which is difficult? So what does the Rashba say about Rabbi Avraham ibn David? If he said it, it's as if you heard it from Moses. That's what he's saying. And that's a bit of hyperbole, right? Obviously, the people do argue on what he says, but he's saying, if he said it, I'm not gonna mess, right? Now, as we'll see, there were a lot of people who argued with the Rabbad. He argued with a lot of people, but he had quite a reputation. Okay. Moving on to his work. So the Rabbad wrote a lot. I hope that you can appreciate this. The Torah, our rabbinic corpus, is incredibly vast. Some of it is more understandable, approachable. Some of it is less so. Some of it is very esoteric. Some of it relates to areas of the law which are totally inapplicable nowadays, right? There's all sorts of laws that deal with purity and impurity, you know, ritual impurity, impurity, laws of the temple, laws of sacrifices that have not been practiced for thousands of years. The Rabbad wrote about everything. And sometimes it's worth appreciating. Most of the time nowadays, right? When a rabbi writes something nowadays, is he writing from new? Is he doing it from scratch? Most of the time, no, right? When a rabbi writes something nowadays, they're writing on a commentary of a commentary of a commentary. The Rabbad had to often work almost from the ground up. And so just to give you a brief, he wrote about the halachic codes, all sorts of treatises on specific laws. He wrote a commentary on the Talmud, on some obscure tracts of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the first rabbinic work of the oral tradition. But he wrote on Mishayot, which are not relevant nowadays, which very few commentators wrote about. All that being said, and we'll get to this next slide in a second, the Rabbad, as we'll see, maybe beginning this week and more next week, was known for his fights, his arguments with other rabbis, and he did not back down, as you will see. If he disagreed with you, he would tell you about it in a very provocative way, as we'll see. Okay, so, but I want to start with this first source. Hey, do you see? So who's that? Who's that in the picture?
Tevye, right?
Because Tevye cares about tradition, right? Tradition, I'm not going to sing it to you now. The Ravid was a man of tradition. And let me just do a quick aside here, okay? Because I think this is a bit tricky. So when you think about this film, The Fiddler on the Roof, which is a play, but the film version of it, I always have mixed feelings. I don't know about you. I'll tell you why. On the one hand, it really does represent a certain reality of the Jew from the old country, right? It's a certain rootedness in tradition, having to deal with the social environment changing around them and trying to find a way to keep the tradition while also advancing. So on the one hand, and there's a lot of truth there. There's a lot of truth to it. But it's also a bit of a mocking tone. And let me tell you what I mean. So if you remember in the play, right, at the very beginning, Tevye is talking and he talks about tradition, right? Do you remember what I mean? And he says, we have all sorts of traditions. And he says, what we wear, everything that we do. And he says, and we wear these fringes on our clothing. What do the fringes obviously refer to? They refer to the mitzvah of tzitzit. And then he says, you may ask, why do we do this? The answer? I don't know. That's what he says. Let me ask you, is that true? Do we not know why men wear fringes on their clothing? Why do we do that? Is that just obscure?
The Torah tells us so.
Yeah, it says in the Torah. It says in the Torah. So it's almost like, you know, giving this impression that, oh, like we made up all these random things that we do and we don't know really why we do them. It's not true. It's not so. We have a very rigorous tradition. That being said, as the Rabbad is going to describe here, it's less clear than you might have thought. And this is where the tradition comes in. So the Rabbad here is introducing a work called Torah Kohanim. Torah Kohanim, I'll get to you one second, Moish. I want to just get to part of the point here. Torah Kohanim is a rabbinic work describing how the rabbis derived many laws from the biblical text. And a lot of times it's not 100% clear. And this is what the Rabbad is going to discuss. Yes, Maish.
There is a huge gap at this time in our journey that makes tzitzit very, very, very not understandable for virtually anybody, including the many Orthodox who don't wear them. And that is very simply, we don't wear four-cornered garments anymore. And therefore, there's no chiyuv. I understand, and many understand, why we do it nonetheless. I'm not even going to get into the shatnas issue, okay? But that in itself, you know, why am I putting tzitzis on to put on a cloth that I would never wear? And that's the only chiyuv. One other thing. Fiddler on the Roof is, let's keep our perspective. It is art. And in art, everything is permitted, okay? Or it's not art.
Okay, so I'm not saying, I'm not objecting. I'm not saying put down.
I know you're talking
out in terms of the way.
One is art, and B, there's reason for it.
Okay. Anyways, but your point's well taken. In terms of tzitzit specifically, I would argue that you're right. We don't have to. But I guess if you're faced with an option of doing a divine commandment or not, it seems like a fair option to do it. It doesn't take that much. You just put the garment on, you're getting a mitzvah wherever, every step that you take. So again, no one's arguing that people have to, you don't have to, but it shows that we're actually interested proactively in doing the divine commands. And I think it actually, I wouldn't say it's outdated because it's a reminder, right? It's a constant reminder. It's a uniform. But that's a specific.
But that's what he said. He, tradition means it's a uniform. That's the point.
Okay? So I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you, but I want to show where I think it really comes from, okay? So look at the Rabban says here, okay? He says as follows, and this is why tradition. The tradition is a father to all of them, all of the different tools we use to learn the Torah. Tradition, an essential to all the mitzvot of the Lord our Master. If not for the tradition, from where would we have the combination of the mitzvot and their meaning? Basically, his point is, it's not like you may think, right? And this is the point. There's a lot of rabbinic traditions. And you might ask, well, why do we have to follow them? Who cares what the rabbi says? The Rabban's point is, if out tradition, we wouldn't have anything. We would barely know what to do. Let's see the examples he gets. From where? In interpreting Bereshit Bara Elokim, that it means in the beginning. How would you know how to read the words Bereshit Bara Elokim? Does it mean in the beginning God created? Does it mean that something called Bereshit created God, which obviously seems a bit heretical? Number one. So number two, and how do you know that Elohim is a name of God? Who says? You know, we have all these names of God. Well, who says our names of God? It's just a word. Even the speech we use to express ourselves, the text we have to pray and ask for all our needs from the Creator, right? This is the text of prayer, of our ritual. If not for a tradition, with what would we ask, right? We wouldn't know how to. I'm not sure what this red line is doing here. I don't know how that got there. I'm going to have to remove it afterwards. I'm sorry about that. And there are many examples you could give. I think I missed some of them here in, right? Sorry, let me go back to this last slide here. Tzitzit, fringes. It doesn't say to take four strings or, you know, where exactly you should put them and what type of garment and what they need to be made out of. And it doesn't say all that in the text. There are hints to it, but it's said generally. It doesn't say, you know, we talk about Sukkot. And on Sukkot, we take the four species. What are the four species, pray tell? Well, it says pre-Eitz Hadar, a beautiful fruit. What's a beautiful fruit? You wouldn't have known that it's an etrog. The rabbis tell you that. So the Rabban's point here is that you may look at what the rabbis are doing and say, well, how do they know that? Who says it's true? And I hear you, but just know that without the rabbis, who are the arbiters of our tradition, we just don't have anything. We don't know how to read the Torah or how to pray or how to perform commandments, any of that. We wouldn't know what to do. Everything that we have today is the product of a tradition which is millennium long. It spans generations. Now, does that mean, and yes, does that mean it cannot change? I don't know. Does that mean that every single thing they said was 100% bona fide truth? I don't know. But I think it certainly does mean that we need to have, the Rabbah is at least saying here, arguing that we need to have a lot of respect for tradition. Therefore, he says, we have to believe very much and trust the words of our wise ancestors, who received from their fathers and their fathers from their fathers regarding all the details of mitzvah midrashim. Even midrash veers from a simple explanation. If it weren't for the fact that the work in front of us is vast and too heavy for us to the limits of our minds and heaviness of our understanding, we would have to devote all of our limbs to explain and present the words of our rabbis so that they may be sought by all who ask and seek them, so they have their full effect. Meaning, if I could, I would spend all my time simply explaining what the rabbis meant to say to the masses, just so that people know what the rabbis were doing here, what their agenda was. It's the most important thing, he says. He says, we would speak about these matters to break the arguments of the heretics who refuse to hear and believe the words of our rabbis, but we hinted at the believers. I can't spend all the time telling you how the rabbis knew this and that and that, but I gave you a bit of an introduction to at least appreciate where they're coming from. And he's wary of people who are obviously there to undermine tradition. So I begin this to you because I think this is a window into the Rabbah's thinking. The Rabbah is a man of tradition. He is here to defend his tradition and the tradition of rabbinic Jewry. And in his zealousy to defend it, he can get a bit aggressive. I'll say that. But I know that Moshe wanted to say something, and I'm sure there's lots to say. So let me pause here for questions for a second. Yes. Thoughts?
All right. Are we good? Yeah, you can hear me. Okay. But that's the beauty of the play. Because when you get to the art involved, they're trying to tell you, we may not know what it is anymore, but it's our tradition. And where we need it, we follow it. And even in a little town where there's no rabbi, and there were hundreds of them, I grew up in one of them, there was, you just follow the tradition. And, you know, it's a great thing. It's a great thing when that's all there is. So, it actually took me till I was 50 to understand the genius of this play. Because that's its genius. You know, it's a lot of other things. It's a lot of other great pieces, great ways of approaching art. But at the end, you know, this is going to sound really funny, but, you know, I can't remember if it's Rav or some other Amora who used to begin each class with some quip or some very, very, very witty thing. That's exactly what tradition is. You know, not everybody went to yeshiva. Some people got their Judaism, maybe as little as it was, from tradition. And it's still around.
100%. I agree with what you're saying. I think, except for the point of what you're saying, where you say where we need to. But 100%, I'm not, again, I agree with what you're saying. My only point is that there isn't, tradition isn't random and arbitrary. There are sources. There is a way that they read the Bible to get it. I think that's the point I'm making, but it's not 100% clear. And we do rely on tradition. I think that's accurate. I also would just say that I think the way that it's portrayed is almost as if it's antiquated and no longer really relevant. And, you know, I think that is something to think about as well. But I hear you. I'm not.
Yeah, you're right there.
I don't want to. I'm not here to say that, you know, no one should ever watch Fiddler on the Roof or, you know, any of the or read Shalom Aleichem. That's not my point. My point is that it makes you think. You know, on the one hand, it presents it tradition in a certain way, but it's true. We are very rooted in tradition. That's what's necessary. Okay, so
an acting career.
Yeah, I have so we have a few minutes left, and I hope that people who try to get on could. I have a very controversial thing to read next, but I think I'm gonna hold off to next week because it's just too much to do with our remaining time. So I'm gonna skip over something. I guess stay tuned for that. And we'll go back to it next week. But let's begin to let me share with you. I'll leave you with some of the vicious back and forth. Okay, so you see here. I have something called the role of men and women. The rabbi has something to say about that, but that's obviously loaded, and I can't do that in 5 minutes. It's just not fair. So let's get to, I'll leave you with one example here, okay? I'll leave you with this, okay? To get you some of the flavor of what the Rambam does here, okay? So this is a chapter from the Rambam. Now, if you may remember last week, what was the Rambam's, what was one of the Rambam's most important contributions to Jewish literature? Anybody remember? What was the Rambam's Mishnah Torah? What's Mishnah Torah?
The second Torah.
Say again?
A second Torah.
A second Torah. We'll get to that, and I'll get to that more next week. So in just a minute, the Mishnah Torah, you know what? Let's actually read it quickly. I skipped it over because I want to get to this specific example to show you how charged the Rabbah's responses were. But he writes as follows, okay? Ramanis says, generally speaking, this is Maimonides, you know, this is in the 12th century, describing what he did. And he says, I author this work so that the reader won't need any other composition in the world for any law among the laws of Israel. Rather, this composition will gather the entirety of the oral tradition with the decrees, customs, and edicts which were issued from the days of Moses, our teacher, until the composition of the Talmud, and as the Geonim explained to us in their composition after the Talmud. Therefore, I have called this composition the companion of Torah. That's how I would translate it. For a person should read the written Torah first and afterward read this. What is the Rambam saying here? What I have done for you is you need nothing else to be a Jew and live in terms of literature, right? Look at this room I'm standing in. There's all sorts of books here, right? You see behind me? I'm in a room full of books. The Rambam says all you need are two. You need two books. You need the Bible and you need my book. And that is it. A bit ambitious, maybe, you think? Like a bit, I don't know. It's quite an impressive undertaking. It's a bit presumptuous. So the Rabbah wasn't so happy with what the Rambam did, generally. And let me give you one example of an objection to the Rambam. Okay, so now we're going to read in the laws of Shabbat about the laws of Kiddush. Right, every Friday night, there is a custom, and Shabbat morning, there is a custom to recite a blessing over a cup of wine, sanctifying the Shabbat day. And this is what the Rambam says. It is a mitzvah to recite a blessing over wine on the Sabbath day before partaking of the second Sabbath meal. This is called the Great Kiddush, Kiddusha Rabbah. One recites only the blessing Borei Pri HaGafen, partakes of the wine, washes one's hands, and begins the meal. On the Sabbath day as well, a person is forbidden to taste any food before he recites Kiddush. This Kiddush may also be recited only in the place where one eats one's meal. To focus on for right now, the Rambam says, and this is an issue, and they're obviously practical, halacha ask your rabbi, there are definitely health considerations which affect this, but the Rambam is saying here is that one should not eat or drink before they recite Kiddush. Agree or disagree? Not crazy, right? It's not anything that's so controversial. This is his ruling. Don't eat or drink before you recite Kiddush and drink the wine. Okay. Says the Rabbah. This is the Rabbah's comment. By my life, if he knows this based on logic, he has never come up with a worse logical argument. That meaning, that's the dumbest thing this man has ever written. Absurd, ridiculous. That's what the Rabbah says about this ruling. Another example here, okay? This is a bit loaded, actually. But, so let me actually hold off on that. The point is, and I'll leave with this question, okay? Because I know we're out of time. The Rambam made a perfectly innocuous halachic ruling saying don't eat before Kiddush. The Rabbah is not just saying you're wrong. He's saying that's the dumbest thing I've ever seen you write. That is absurd. Why would you write such a thing? Why so vicious? Why so vicious? Why not just say, no, you can't eat before Kiddush? Like what? Why do you have to write? It's the worst argument I've ever read. So that's what I want to begin to talk about next week. We spoke about Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan today. We talked about the Rabbah, the beginning of his life, his biography, and his rootedness in tradition. And next week, I hope to continue that discussion and hopefully at least get a bit into the more rational side of thinking, the notion that we can move a little bit and be flexible with tradition. And so looking forward to that. Thank you all so much for joining. I hope you didn't have too much trouble getting into here, and have a wonderful week.
Right.